at this time, he would assign me the longest book of the New Testament to cover in one lesson. You know, I couldn't even cover Philemon in one lesson, so it'll probably take two. We'll see how it goes. Let's see some quick facts from the book of Luke first, just to sort of get a feel for the book. Everyone is familiar with it, but some of the interesting things about it that make it different from Matthew, Mark, and John. Of course, here is the 42nd book of the Bible, the third book of the New Testament. It's the longest book of the New Testament, 1,151 verses. That's a little longer than Matthew at 1,071 and a little longer than Acts at 1,006. You'll notice that Luke is the author of two of the longest books of the New Testament, Luke and Acts. This is sometimes called the Gospel of the Underdog because as you read through it, you notice that there is an emphasis on Gentiles, on women, on parents, children, outcasts, the sick, the lost. And there's definitely a different flavor to this than, for instance, reading the book of Matthew, as we'll notice in a moment, the different emphases. And this is a book that a lot of people can relate to because they feel like they're more in tune with the gospel of the underdog. We make our mistakes. We understand our frailties. And Jesus does too. And that's the emphasis of the book of Luke. The key verse of the book, if you'd like to turn and read that, is Luke chapter 19, verse 10. Most people can quote that verse. This is from the section that deals with Zacchaeus, the wee little man that we sing about. But he was a man who had an important job. He was not well respected in his community, but he surely has been respected since because of this interaction with Jesus and the attitude that he had toward Jesus. But in the midst of that context of talking to Zacchaeus, Jesus made this statement about his mission in life, the reason he came. For the Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which was lost. So if you mark in your Bible, you might want to note that that is the key verse. Of course, there are other verses that could also be called the key verse, but it seems to me that verse would be a good summary of the book of Luke, and we'll see that a little bit more as we develop this class. Some of the key words and phrases of the book, the phrase that we just read in that passage, Son of Man, is used 26 times in the book of Luke. That obviously is slightly more than one per chapter. There are 24 chapters and it's used 26 times. The kingdom of God is found 32 times in the book. So this is a book about the kingdom or the church. Now the difference in Luke and Matthew uses the phrase kingdom of heaven, whereas Luke uses the phrase kingdom of God. There's no difference in what they mean, but just a slightly different way of expressing the same thing. Angels are referred to in this book 23 times. That's an interesting fact. We only know the names of two angels, Michael and Gabriel. Gabriel, of course, is mentioned in relation to the birth of John the Baptist and Jesus in Luke chapters 1 and 2. Some other key words or phrases. This is a book of joy. The word joy and rejoicing is found 19 times in the book. There are lots of references to law and lawyers. Now, some of those in the parables, those words are used 18 times. The phrase fear not is found 8 times. So you get a little flavor of the book just by seeing the emphases that are found, the different words that are used more often than they are in other books. This is a book that is a part of a two-part series. We mentioned earlier that Luke also wrote the book of Acts. So here you have the prequel to the two. In Luke, the first chapter, verses 1 through 4, you have Luke's introduction where he says that these are the things that Jesus began both to do and to teach. And then Acts, could be said of it, these are the things that Jesus continued to do and to teach. Now, obviously, Jesus has gone back to heaven in the book of Acts, but he is still accomplishing his will on earth through these men that he trains to be his apostles, guided by the Holy Spirit, who take the message that he gave them and carry it to the world, that promote the church that he bought with his blood. In the last part of Luke, the account of the cross, purchasing the church so that the church could be in the world, and then that message, the good news of the resurrection, the salvation offered through Jesus, is found in the book of Acts as it begins to go from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, uttermost parts of the earth. I came across this little chart. I used it here in 2012, so you may remember that, but I thought it would be interesting to put it back up here just to show the contrast between the book of Luke and the book of Acts and how Acts is a bridge between the gospel accounts and the epistles. I'll just go through this really quickly. It may be small from where you're sitting, but hopefully you can read this. Notice in Luke you have the ministry of Jesus as he was on earth. By contrast, Acts is the ministry of Jesus from heaven as he's ruling over his kingdom. In Luke you have the teachings of Jesus. In Acts you have the teaching of the apostles. In Luke you have the introduction of the gospel. In Acts you have the progress of the gospel. In Luke, you have Christ revealed historically. We'll talk about that in our class. And then in the book of Acts, you have Christ revealed mystically, how he could still be with his disciples, even though he was not physically on the earth. In Luke, you have Christ for us. He's our offering. But in Acts, you have Christ in us. He is our friend. In Luke, you have a book that begins with the events surrounding the coming of Christ to the earth. But Acts begins with the ascension of Christ back to heaven. And then the book of Luke ends with the disciples in Jerusalem. And the book of Acts ends with the disciple, or the apostle Paul at least, in Rome. The gospel has made it all the way to the capital city. So that, to me, puts an interesting overview on the book and helps to place the puzzle pieces together in a way that helps us to see, if you were in an airplane, maybe the 50,000 feet view when you're looking down on it and you're able to see the bigger picture, and then we're going to go back into some of the same information and see the 10,000 feet view, which is where we can sit a little bit in more detail. In Luke, Jesus is preaching. In the epistles, Jesus is being preached. And the book of Acts bridges those two ideas, because it goes from the emphasis on the man in the first four books of the New Testament to the emphasis upon his message in the end of the New Testament. And the book of Acts shows us how that Jesus went back to heaven, the church began to carry his message to the world, and then those churches that were talked about in the epistles were established. Let's talk about four ideas this morning, major points. Each of these we will discuss if we have time. In some detail. The first point, Jesus sits for his third portrait. You might wonder, why are there four accounts of the gospel? Here we are, we've read Matthew, we've read Mark by this point. Someone might say, another book about Jesus? Didn't we just read about him not once but twice? Why do we keep going back to the same person again and again and again? Well, it really is more like three chapters in a book about one person. Because these, even though these are some of the longest books of the New Testament, they are extremely brief when you consider only 1,000 sentences in the longest of them, 1,100, 1,200 sentences or verses. Well, that wouldn't even fill a good size booklet. And yet, here you have the most important person who's ever lived, whose life is being discussed. Sometimes it's expressed this way. Is one picture enough of a person that you love? I mean, those of you who are grandparents in here, for instance, do you only have one picture of a grandchild in your possession? Don't you have a picture in your wallet? Don't you have a picture blown up on your wall in your living room? Don't you have a baseball picture? Don't you have a newborn picture? Don't you have a school portrait? Don't you have, for those who are older, a graduation picture? All these different portraits of the same person. Why is that? Isn't one picture enough? Well, no, not one picture can't really capture everything about a person. They're different perspectives. Same thing is true with Jesus, the most important person who ever lived. One picture is not enough of him. And each one of these accounts of his life gives us a different emphasis and helps us to see different things about him. In Matthew, as Brandon has taught us, he is Israel's king. In Mark, He is God's servant, or man's, the servant of man, Jehovah's servant. Both of those would be correct. I actually corrected my notes, not on the PowerPoint, but my other notes, to say man's servant, because Mark 10:45 says he came not to be served or ministered to, but to minister and to give his life for many. And then in Luke, he is the perfect man. And in John, he is the Son of God. So those are all important ideas. And if you want to talk about who the fulfillment of prophecy is, who the predicted Messiah was of the Jews, the Hebrew Old Testament, well, the place to go would be Matthew, because he makes that point. He shows that Jesus is the one they were expecting. But when you go to Mark, writing to the Romans, Romans didn't care about a Jewish king. But they did care about people who accomplished things. They did care about people who were active and busy and successful. And so you don't have a record of Jesus' birth in the book of Mark, as we'll see later in today's lesson, because nobody paid any attention when a servant was born. What they wanted to know when they went to the servant auction in the Roman Empire was, what can this servant do? How strong is he? What abilities does he have? What can he do for me? What has he accomplished in his life? Well, that's the emphasis of the book of Mark. Jesus is man's servant. Here's the things, as we saw last week, anon, immediately, straightway, again and again and again, Jesus was here, he did this, Jesus was there, he worked this miracle, Jesus was here and he helped this person. So it's a book of action. You come to the book of Luke written to the Greeks, and the Greeks were more philosophical, and they were more interested in the ideal man, the perfect person. And Luke says, here I found him. The only perfect person who ever lived. Let me tell you about him. And his name is Jesus. And then in the book of John, probably written a little bit later and written as a supplement to the others so that we have emphasis and information that was not included in what are called the synoptic gospels. If you read very many commentaries or books that explain Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you'll see that word synoptic. It means, it's a compound word, it means to see together. And so Matthew, Mark, and Luke have the same, they're very much alike. John is very much different. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are about 80% the same and 20% different. But John is 80% different and 20% the same as the previous ones. So he really supplements. For instance, he covers the first year of Jesus' ministry in John 1-5, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't even talk about that first year. So you have a whole year of Jesus, of the 3 years, 33% or close to it, of Jesus' personal ministry is covered only by John, and therefore you would expect his book to be a little different. But John's emphasis is Jesus is the Son of God. Now, when you take those four books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and you just pick up the New Testament, begin to read, and you get to that point. Did you know that you have now read 48% of the New Testament in terms of volume or content? Half of the New Testament is about one man. Because if you understand Jesus, if you fall in love with Him, then the rest of the New Testament will fall into place. But if you don't understand the lordship of Jesus, for instance, if you don't understand why he came, what he taught, who he was, then you can never understand Acts through Revelation, because those are built on the foundation of Jesus' life. And really we say four books about one life, but to be more specific, you're really talking about four books about 3.5 years of one life, 42 months. But even then, I think I learned this from Brandon, even then you're only talking about 50 days of 3.5 years. So a little less than 2 months is all that we really know of Jesus' life. 50 different days, not consecutive, but here the historians, the whole guided by the Spirit, are choosing from these 3.5 years, this day, this day, this day, this day, putting them, and then you put them together chronologically, and you have just about 2 months of Jesus' life. And even of that 2 months, most of the emphasis is on the last 7 days, the last month, building up to Jesus' crucifixion, then the last week, and then the last, you have more about Tuesday of that week than any other day. But you have, of course, the pivotal day is the day when he was crucified and his resurrection, Friday and Sunday. All right, let's talk a little bit more about sitting for his third portrait just to see the contrast between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, these synoptic gospels. And Matthew, the emphasis is on what Jesus said. If you have a red letter Bible and you just flip through the pages of Matthew, you'll see a lot of red because you have these long speeches that Jesus made. For instance, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, three long chapters. You have the Olivet Discourse, Matthew chapters 24 and 25, two whole chapters, long chapters that were one speech that Jesus made. So it's more on what Jesus said. And Mark is more on what Jesus did. It's the gospel of the miracles of Jesus, the deeds of Jesus. But Luke is on Jesus himself, the person. What made him tick? How did he think? How did he behave? His compassion, his inner fortitude. In Matthew, we have significant groupings. When you try to put together chronology of the life of Jesus, it seems like it would be easy to do, but if you've ever tried to do it, it's not easy to do. Even scholars who really have spent all their lives studying the life of Jesus have difficulty. You could pick up a book like McGarvey's Fourfold Gospel and then compare it to some other chronological treatments of Jesus' life, and they'll be different because it's really hard to put these things in order. One of the reasons is because we don't know exactly when Jesus did what Jesus did. We know that he did it. We don't know when he did it. And one reason is because the gospel accounts are not necessarily written in chronological order. They are generally in chronological order. They start with his birth and they go to his death. But Matthew especially takes the life of Jesus and he pulls out sections of it that fall into certain categories and groups them together in his book. For instance, in Matthew 8 and 9, you have all these miracles that Jesus did. That's his emphasis there. He's talking about miracles in those two chapters. But those miracles occurred not on the same day or the same week, but over the 3.5 years. But he groups them together in his miracle section of his book. Same thing with parables in Matthew chapter 13. He groups all these parables that Jesus told in one chapter, even though they were spread out on different days. Jesus didn't stand up and preach, you know, one sermon with all these parables in it and Matthew back there writing it down and puts it in his book just like it happened. No, Jesus taught these things, but he taught them on different days. And then Matthew groups them. The Jews were, they did a lot of memorizing of the Bible. And they taught their children that way. We mentioned that in the genealogical records. We studied that boring list of names a few weeks ago, how there were three groups of 14. Because they would memorize, it was easy to remember lists that were equal in number. And so it's another grouping in Matthew. Then, Mark, we have successive snapshots. Heard a sermon by Johnny Ramsey, and I used to preach it. I love this sermon. Luke is my favorite account of the gospel right now because I've been studying it this week, but at different times, each one of them is my favorite. And for a while, Mark was my favorite. Only 16 chapters, the shortest of them. And Brother Ramsey did a lesson where he would take a single snapshot of Jesus' life, one per chapter from Mark, 16 snapshots, and he would preach on these pictures like you were flipping through a family album. It was quite an interesting sermon. And that's really how Mark writes. He just takes these snapshots of things Jesus did and puts them in this book about him. But then in Luke, by contrast to those groupings, topical groupings, the snapshots, and then in Luke we have a beautifully told story. Luke is the easiest, if you just want to pick up a book and read about the life of Jesus, Luke is the easiest and the most comprehensive one to read because he fills in a lot more details than the other Matthew, Mark, and especially John. I think Brandon said this last week, and I'd never learned this before, but I think he's definitely right about it. Mark, if he covers something, he gives more detail about it, but he just doesn't cover very many things compared to Matthew and Luke. Peculiarities of Luke. Any good Bible commentary would do this with any book that you pick up, because this is a good way to, in your mind, separate the different books of the Bible and remember things from them. So what's different about Luke as compared to the others? Well, 59% of the content of Luke is different. That'll vary a little bit. Some of that's subjective, but that's pretty close. 541 verses of the 1,151 have no parallel in the other gospel accounts. So that would be about 59% of the content. There are 732 words not found elsewhere in the New Testament, only found in Luke. And Brandon sent me his notes on Luke. This is one thing I learned from what he would have taught if he was here today. I mean, if he was up here today. The 732 words, Luke has the widest vocabulary of any New Testament writer, rivaled only possibly by the Apostle Paul. And they were traveling companions and good friends, and what some conversations they must have had with their educational backgrounds being so similar. Also peculiar to Luke are 6 of the 20 miracles that are recorded in Luke. I want to say, I'll read these just for the audio. You would not be able to write these down, but don't also just ignore this. Just let this wash over you as I go through and think about how robbed we would be if we didn't have Luke, and how blessed we are because we have this book. The miracles that are only included in Luke include the drought of fishes, chapter 5, 4 through 11. The raising of the widow's son in chapter 7. The woman with a spirit of infirmity who was healed, chapter 13. The man with dropsy who was healed, chapter 14. The 10 lepers who were healed. You remember, one turned back to thank him, Luke 17. And then Malchus's ear being reattached after Peter cut it off during the arrest, Luke 22, 50 to 51. And then 10 of the 35 parables. You'll read different numbers here. The reason for that is people define parables in different ways. Some people will call a simile a parable, other people won't. And so, but these, at least these 10 parables, some people will say 7, some 10, some 19. But at least these 10, in my estimate, are parables that are not included in the other, anywhere else in the Bible. And this is quite a list, and I think as you listen to it, you'll be impressed with how blessed we are to have Luke, and how robbed we would be not to have these teachings. The parable of the two debtors, chapter 7. The parable of the good Samaritan, chapter 10. The parable of the importunate friend who came at midnight, you know, about prayer, chapter 11. The parable of the rich fool, the farmer, Luke 12. The barren fig tree, Luke 13. The woman who lost a piece of silver, chapter 15. The prodigal son, chapter 15. The unjust servant, the unjust steward in chapter 16. The unjust judge in chapter 18. And then the Pharisee and the publican in chapter 18, 9 to 14. Those are some peculiarities of the book. Now let's talk about a second point. That was pretty technical. We'll get a little less technical now. But I think that information is good to have and good to remember. And incidentally, I should have said this at the beginning. I don't know how you, I see a lot of you taking notes. I've encouraged you, and I think most of us do, make notes in our Bibles. These are the kind of notes that if you have space at the top of the book, like this is Luke chapter 1, and my particular Bible has a little introduction to the book. And of course, that's always good when you're reading through the Bible, just to read that, and it gives you some of the details that will help you to appreciate what you're reading. But then if there's space around it, and some of you may have a wide margin Bible where you have more space to write, this is the kind of information that I try to write when I come to a book. Like just in this one, this wasn't a part of today's preparation, but I've written 37 parables in Luke. Starts with the birth of Jesus. It's written to Gentiles, explains Jewish customs. Key verse, 19:10, most chronological and checkable of the Gospels. And about 10 more things that I had room to write. This is the kind of stuff that's on this PowerPoint. that you can transfer later over to your Bible, because your notebook you probably will keep somewhere, but when you may not have it when you read the book of Luke next time, and so if it's written in the book itself, then that could be more practical. Point number two, the book of Luke deals with, or is, the third portrait of Jesus, but it deals with the four journeys that Jesus made. The good physician, or the great physician, makes house calls. And Luke, more than any of the other writers, emphasizes Jesus as the compassionate healer of men. That makes sense, as he himself was a doctor, Colossians 4:10-14. And you see Jesus as the healer. We'll talk about that probably next week. But from the 25,000 feet view, as we look down on the book and sort of get the sections of the book so we can appreciate where we are when we're reading it. One source I was reading said that Luke must have loved to travel, because his books are really travel guides. The book of Luke begins with the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem, and then it ends with the death of Jesus in Jerusalem. So he's made a circuit almost all the way back to where he started. In the book of Acts, which Luke also wrote, it begins in Jerusalem and takes a journey all the way to Rome. And I came across this last night. This is from Stanford University. They came up with a little, it's not really a chart, it's more like a tool where you can plug in different numbers and then it will give you the results of it. And what it's for, it's not for Paul's journeys, I just applied it to that. It took the Roman Empire in AD 200 and helped, you could figure how long it would take to go from any place in the Roman Empire and how much it would cost you to make a journey. Of course, that's just a little bit after the missionary journeys of Paul, but it was pretty detailed. It even went into the wave height, the winds, the currents, and so forth, how much it would cost, how long it would take. At any rate, that's far more detail than we need for this, but I was looking for the distance that Paul traveled in his journeys. I had read somewhere it was about 12,000 miles that Paul traveled in carrying the gospel. Well, if you add up those numbers, it's 10,282 miles. That was mostly by ship. And Luke was with him for a good portion of that. When you read the book of Acts, famously, there are we passages and they passages. They passages are when Luke, as the writer, is saying Paul and his other companions went here, they went. But then, other times he says we went here. Obviously, he had joined the traveling party. So, you know, and I could go ahead and put that up here if you want to jot this down. Uh-oh. It'll put me back up there. I must have hit the wrong button. There we go. Here we are. These are the we passages, Acts 16, Acts 20 and 21, Acts 27 and 28. So if Paul traveled 10,000 miles or 12,000 miles, then Luke traveled with him probably two-thirds of those, because he made the longest journey from Jerusalem back to Rome with Paul. I said all that just to say Luke knew about travel. He must have enjoyed travel. And certainly the book of Luke is a book about Jesus' travels. And I'll just give you an outline and then we will move on to the next point. The theme of the book of Luke could be expressed, our Lord's journeys as the Son of Man. And here's an outline. Chapter 1 through 4, 13, Jesus' journey from heaven to earth. This is a section that Luke includes far more information than we have anywhere else in the New Testament. You would know very little about Jesus before he was 30 years old if you didn't have Luke, because he's almost the only one that talks about this. Now, Matthew, as we've seen recently, has a little bit of information about the birth of Jesus, but even Matthew doesn't really cover much of the birth. He just shows that it's a fulfillment of prophecy, and he includes the visit of the wise men of the Magi, and Herod's threat against him that Luke doesn't include. But all that information is really peripheral to the main event of Jesus actually being born. And the record we have is only in Luke of that, in Luke 2, 1-7. And then the boyhood of Jesus, when Jesus went at age 12 to Jerusalem, and there he interacted with the doctors of the law, and he got lost. His parents left him. You remember that story? That's only in Luke chapter 2. The baptism of Jesus, of course, is covered in other places. Chapters 3 and 4 of Luke cover the baptism and the temptation of Jesus. About now, you're thinking, I really wish Brandon was teaching today. He does not go into all this boring detail. But I hope that this will be of some interest. I'll go ahead and put all four of these, the last three of these. The journey from heaven to earth is first. Second, the journey throughout Galilee. That's where Jesus spent most of his time, especially early in his ministry. Chapters 4 through 19, 4:14 through 9:17. And then the journey to Jerusalem in chapter 9:18 through 19:27. You notice that's 10 chapters long in Luke. And that is almost all new material, because Matthew and Mark only mention it, but briefly. But Luke includes, there are like 7 different references where it says Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. And so it was a major part of the book of Luke. And Jesus was going to Jerusalem, of course, to die. That's the middle section of the book, chapter 9:18 through 19:27. Sometimes in the commentaries it'll be called the great insertion, because Luke inserts it into the account where it's ignored in others. And then the journey within Jerusalem, chapters 19:28 through 24:53. That's at the end of his life, culminating, of course, in his crucifixion. Point number 3. We talked about Jesus sitting for his third portrait. We talked about Jesus, the great physician, makes house calls, the journeys of Jesus. And then number 3, first class history, Jesus lived in real time. I think this is the most interesting point to me. It may not be for you, but I really enjoy history. And the thing that I had never really thought about when it comes to the gospel accounts, unlike other false religions, the once upon a time religions, that they have obscure beginnings, or they have falsified beginnings. The gospel is not once upon a time in a land far away kind of story. It's time stamped. It's dated. You could go check. Really, the whole Bible's this way, which is interesting. You could read your World Sieve book in, you know, or 1 and 2. 1 for the Old Testament, go back to the Babylonians, the Sumerians, and the Assyrians, and all those ancient Egyptians, the ancient civilizations. And you put that up beside the Bible, and the Bible is parallel with that. When these things were happening historically, well, the Bible is referring to the kings that were living at that time, and it's checkable. When you get to the New Testament, the same thing is true, and especially in Luke, because Luke gives us more chronological information than anybody else. You can check it. You can go see, okay, who was supposed to be ruling the Roman Empire when Jesus was born? Well, Caesar Augustus. Well, you read in the Bible, Luke chapter 2, which we'll do in a moment, Caesar Augustus, you go to your Roman history book, and Caesar Augustus is right where he's supposed to be. It's checkable, and that gives, that makes the historical aspect of Christianity verifiable. Well, I'll spend a little bit of time here. I just want to read some verses with you and show you how Luke time stamps his epistle or his account of Jesus' life. This is far more than the others do. The only parallel with this really that I can think of is Mark gives us, he time stamps the crucifixion of Jesus. 9 o'clock in the morning it starts, 12 o'clock, the sun goes, it gets dark, and then 3 o'clock he dies. Well, that's, Mark gives you that information. Luke gives us that kind of information throughout the book. Just read with me, if you will, some of these. Luke. Luke chapter 1 verse 5, there was in the days of Herod, king of Judea. You see, he's driven down a tent post here saying these events happened in real time in world history, and here's the king who was alive when it happened. And chapter 1 verse 36. Behold, thy cousin Elizabeth, she hath also conceived a son in her old age, and this is the sixth month with her that is called barren. Now, we know exactly how much older Jesus is than John because we have that time stamp. John was 6 months older than Jesus because Jesus was conceived 6 months after John the Baptist was conceived. You drop down to verse 56 of chapter 1, and Mary abode with Elizabeth about 3 months and returned to her own house. So if she was 6 months pregnant in chapter 1, verse 30, 1, verse 36, then she's about to have her baby, obviously. And then Mary goes back and she's 3 months, so she has 6 months to go. Then the next time stamp is verse 59, where it says, and it came to pass that on the eighth day they came to circumcise the child. That's John the Baptist. It's another chronological marker. Chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. I'll come back and read that with you later, because I want to emphasize something there. Chapter 2, verse 7, the birth of Jesus. He's born, wrapped in swaddling clothes. I've drawn a line from verse 7 over to verse 21, and when the 8 days were accomplished. So you know exactly how many days have taken place between verse 7 and verse 21. 8 days later, well, that was what the law said. They were supposed to circumcise the child on the eighth day, and that's what they do. And then I drew another line down to verse 22, the word accomplished. And when the days of her purification according to the law of Moses were accomplished, well, it doesn't say how many days that was, but you can write in your margin Leviticus 12:4. That was 33 days later. So we know exactly, so you can mark the time that's passing. Then in chapter 2, verse 42, and when Jesus was 12 years old, someone said you could write over Luke 1 and 2, chapters 1 and 2, in the days of Herod, because that's what you're talking about, the first two chapters, the days of Herod. Over chapters 3 and 4, you could put 30 years later. Now, when you just read through, you don't really get that you just passed 3 decades of time when you went from chapter 2 to chapter 3. Now, in chapter 2, you've gone 12 years in time between verse 40 and verse 41. Jesus went from being the baby or the 2-year-old that returned from Egypt, and now he's 12 years old. So a whole decade has passed at that point. We don't have any record of anything that happened when Jesus was a boy, except in general he increased the wisdom and stature and favor of God and man. All right, the next one is chapter 3, verse 23. This is the only time in the Bible it tells how old Jesus was when he began his personal ministry. When he, as it were, took his sign down on the carpenter shop, locked the door for the last time, walked out, and became a preacher. When did that happen? How old was he? Chapter 3, verse 23 tells you. He was about 30, 23. And Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being as it was supposed. So he's 30. That would be the age a person would begin serving as a priest, too. So that was a significant number in the Jewish culture. Chapter 9, verse 20. I won't read all these others with you, but I'll save them for the audio. These are very interesting, though. Chapter 9, verse 29, 37. Chapter 22, 1. 22:7, 22:66, 23:44, 54, 24:1, 24:13, 24:29, 24:33. All those show that Luke is very meticulous in giving the dates and the times that the events are happening. And if you're interested in this kind of thing, and sometimes it's very helpful, especially if you're trying to put together a chronology, then these verses help to know exactly when Jesus did what he did and what came first and what came after. Luke is by far the most chronological of the New Testament writers. This is an example here in Luke 3. There are 6 markers, time markers, that he gives for the birth of Well, let's just read this. Chapter 3, 1 and 2. Now in the 15th year, that's number 1, of Tiberius Caesar, of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. I put a little number 1 beside this and 2, 3, 4 in the text if you want to do that. Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, that's 1, 2, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and 3, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and 4, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea and the region of Trachonitis, and 5, Licinius, the tetrarch of Abilene, and 6, Annas and Caiaphas being the high priest. You see how you could date, you can go to the history books and check up on this. Well, were all these men ruling at the same time? Go check on it. See if the Bible is verifiable. And the answer to that is yes, they were. Luke is extremely accurate. I'm going to pick up there. We're just really getting to the good part, at least in my estimate. But next week we'll talk about that, if that's okay with Brandon. We'll pick up. What I want to do with you is, with the birth of Jesus in Luke 2, step back away from that and see how God set everything up to be exactly what He predicted it to be. And Luke verifies it in those two verses, to show that what God said in the Old Testament came to pass in the New Testament. Anybody have a question or a comment? Brandon would be happy to answer any questions this morning. All right. Thanks for your attention. Brandon, would you come up and lead us in a prayer, please, as we close out? Thank you.